Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Do you consider that you grow up in a strict family?
So with the Haitian community and like raising children, it's a lot much more restricted and stuff like that.
I have more of a sense of urgency as an adult. Like I can make decisions easily because I was allowed to make my own decisions from when I was young.
I'm Nigerian. I was raised in a Christian home. Back then, it's very strict, but I think that was for good because you know what? I became very disciplined.
So I grew up in Philadelphia, mixed black family, but I'm African. I kind of grew up with my culture. I didn't get to explore what I could do with my life as a child. I said, I'm not doing this no more.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Welcome to the show. I'm talking this week with Sophia Sinclair. She's an award-winning poet and essayist who teaches creative writing at Arizona State University and who grew up in Jamaica in a household governed by Rastafari teachings under the strict rule of her father. Rastafari is much more and much different than how it shows up in pop culture as, you know, reggae music or as a style choice or just as an appropriated vibe in bad movies. It's actually an anti-colonial, pro-black way of living. But for Sophia, it was also a complicated, often painful childhood. She revisits that time and tries to learn from it in her new memoir, How to Say Babylon. And she joins me to talk about the book, about her journey, and about the history of Rasta. Sophia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
So place is a really big part of your writing. So let's start there. Where is home for you?
You know, whenever I get asked this question, I always say home for me is Jamaica. Home for me is Montego Bay. We call it the second city in Jamaica. It's the second largest city. It's a coastal town. You know, most people kind of know it as this sort of tourist destination. But for me, you know, it was where I was born, where my family was born. And I was born in this small sea village close to the airport in Montego Bay called White House. That's where my mother is from and her family, a family of fishermen are from. My grandfather actually had a hand in the name of the town because when he arrived there almost a century ago, my great-grandfather, he painted his house on the beach white. And from there came the name of the town, White House.
Wow.
Yeah.
When do you remember when it registered for you that you were Rastafari, that that's how you were being raised?
You know, I always kind of knew my parents were different because they were the only people I saw when I was a child who had dreadlocks, who talked about Haile Selassie, you know, who had different rules about what they ate and different rules about how my mother dressed. And so I knew they were different. I had that concept as a child. But it was when my parents decided that they were going to... my mom, like, twisted my hair into dreadlocks, me and my siblings. And that was the first moment where I was like, oh, okay, I'm, like, part of this thing, Rastafari. And it really registered because after that Christmas, after my mom, like, twisted my hair into dreadlocks and I went back to school for the first time, I was mercilessly teased.
No, and really? You were how old?
I was 8. And there was this one student or a couple students at school who would follow me around and like taunt me and sing this song, Lice is Killing the Rasta, over and over. And I was like, wow, that was kind of the first moment of realization of like, okay, I'm not only different, like I always knew my family was different, but okay, now there is this new consequence or frame to it. And I started to think about my selfhood in a different way for the first time, yeah.
At what point did you begin to realize that not only did being Rasta make you different from other kids, but also being a girl who is Rasta meant something particular?
You know, I would say around 9, I started to see it because, you know, my brother and I were only 2 years apart and we were very close when we were growing up. And I remember there was a moment where I felt that there was a shift in the way, you know, the paths that we were both on. I remember there was, we used to climb trees all the time. Like, I was wild, right? So I was up in the trees. But I remember there was a day my father said, you can't climb trees anymore. It's unladylike. Like, that's done. But not my brother, right? And I was like, well, what is this? Like, this makes no sense. And then he, when I was 9, made the decree that none of his daughters would ever wear pants or shorts again, and told my mother to throw them all away, which she did. And so now there were these rules of you can only wear dresses and long skirts and so on. That was 9, right? And then I began to see, oh, it's not just that I have dreadlocks now. It's like more, it's more. You know, I never had made this connection, even though I'd seen all these Rasta sistren who had their hair like wrapped up, you know, in that we call it a tie head in Jamaica. And they did dress this way. But I was 9. I didn't think that had anything to do with me. And until then it did. Mm. And so that's when I began to think about it, when I saw the rules kind of diverging between me and my brother, and it happened simply because I was a girl.
Yeah. What was your relationship to your mother within the context of this as someone who was an enforcer of these changing rules?
You know, I never, when I was growing up, thought about her as an enforcer, you know, in that way. Because she also made my world, for me and my siblings, she made the world feel so expansive. You know, when I talk about all these rules, it would kind of seem like, wow, your world was getting smaller.
Yeah.
But it was through my mother that for a long time, it just felt like the world was still ours for the taking. Because when we were home, she gave us the love of books and of literature and of imagination and play and a love of nature, which she actually made into her own kind of curriculum. Like, so I always saw her as someone who expanded my world.
Yeah. And it was your mother who introduced you to poetry, right?
So poetry was always a natural part of my growing up. And Jamaica itself, we are, culturally, we celebrate poetry and elocution across the island. Mm. We have even contests where that's aired on, you know, national TV, where students go and recite poetry and for medals, you know? And so this is also entrenched in our nation as culturally important. And so, but in my house, my mother was the one who first handed me that first collection of poems. And she told me what poetry meant to her. And this was in a moment of deep hurt. I was 10 years old, and someone I thought was my friend said, I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to be friends with a Rasta.
Oh, wow.
And I was so hurt, and my mom could feel that hurt, and she handed me this collection of poems, and she said poetry had always expanded the world for her. Poetry had always made the world feel wider and warmer for her. And she said, I think you might like to read this. And so, yeah, I began reading the poems, and I came across a poem, and I just remember the feeling of, like, I could feel that hurt evaporating, or this idea of that whatever I was feeling could be alchemized into something else. through poetry. And I wrote my first poem like that around that time at 10 years old. And it just continued from there, you know, and I began writing poems about my love of Jamaica, of the landscape, of the sea. And in adolescence, then I discovered Plath and other poets who were confessional. And I thought, oh, the gaze also can turn inward, that there is an interior landscape here that could be explored. And so I began to write poetry from, you know, the self, from the sort of, I think of it as the catacombs of myself. There, too, poems can come. And then I published my first poem when I was 16 in the newspaper in Jamaica. And it kind of just went from there and never stopped.
First, a poet at 10.
Poet at 10.
And a published poet at 16. Okay, everybody, get to it. You get, this is a high bar. That it's been. What a wonderful act of parenting.
Yes.
To give your child a poem to try to heal.
Yes.
Do you recall what that collection was or who was the poet?
It was a collection called Poems from a Child's World. The poem that I remember that struck me the most was a poem called The Tiger by William Blake. You know, okay. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. And I just remember the image kind of just obliterating any hurt I'd been feeling. This, I was like, what is this strange magic? Like, what is this sorcery happening on the page? And I went to the encyclopedia. We had one of those old ones that was like an actual book. And I like flipped through looking at, who's this William Blake? And it said he had died like almost 150 years ago. And I was like, what?
Wow. Yeah.
And I was like, wow, so this is what poetry can do. Poetry is a way to outlive myself and what I can leave behind me. And there was no looking back after that.
Right. You encounter that kind of power. You're like, I'm doing that. That's
like,
for me.
I'm like, this is what I need to be doing.
That's great. After a break, Sophia Sinclair shares one of her poems, and we learn the history of Rasta. This is Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Stay with us.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Dread not I. Dread from the sea I was drawn, I blue as dread, tender dread, taloned as our future dread. Dread the constellation I was born under, dread I slept under, dread the waves of history blustering red. Dread my mother's calm, dread the harpy's song, dread she nursed me, dread she named me, dread my girlhood on the sugarcane, dread the hurricane. I was a child of dread, a psalm of dread, dread pressed into my palm like the blessed herb, a divine dread, Rastaman said. Before I could speak, there was dread. Before I could stumble, dread roamed the shore, a ghostly spume, dreadless thread of the woman I'm erasing, dread my one coastline crumbling to sea rise, to abyss, Dread my dead tooth on making the veil. Dread the ointment eye. Dread the wound eye. Dread the whale eye. Dread the jonquil's eye. Smoke of black clouds heralding only dread. Skirmish of youth, my constant banner of dread. Dread at home, dread to the bone, my father dangling his guillotine of dread. Dread as daily bread, nursed dark by decades of dread. Teachers recoiled at my knotted thorns of dread. How the white girls blanched with dread, scorned for the hair on my head. Beware my black heart of dread, the reckless haunt of my dread. Girl born of nothing but salt air and dread. Girl who bore nothing but a vision of dread. Such a savage dread, thrum of the natty dread. Congo bongo dread, martyred was the dread. Brother still the dread, blood of my dread. Babylon maiming families of dread. Pastors railing against our dread. Dread the crown of heavens I wear upon this head. Dread at the root, dread of the fruit. Sister of the dread, daughter of the dread. First woman giving birth to her dread. A gorgon stoning every bald head. Dead.
This is Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright, and that was poet and essayist Sophia Sinclair reading her poem, Planet Dread. Her new memoir, How to Say Babylon, revisits her childhood as a girl being raised Rastafari in Jamaica. And Sophia, the line in that poem, my father wielding the guillotine of his dread. Tell me about that.
You know, with the poem, I wanted to kind of explore all the different ways that dread defined my childhood, and all the different ways that we can kind of explore dread. So, you know, I grew up in a pretty strict authoritarian household that it was connected to the Rastafari movement and the rules that were sort of imposed in every household, which kind of changed from house to house. There's no like overarching, there's no book, there's no Bible of Rastafari. And so from the sort of basic tenets of, you know, black liberation, the purity of what, you know, keeping your body, your temple clean and pure for Jah. Beyond that, most Rasta brethren kind of are the godhead in each household, and they kind of sort of change and shift the rules to however they see fit. And so growing up, I have two sisters. So my sisters, my mother and I, we kind of had different rules about how women were supposed to be inside of Rastafari. And that manifested in how we should dress, how we should speak or not speak. You know, sort of silence and obedience were the virtues of womanhood. We were supposed to cover our arms and our knees. We were not supposed to wear jewelry or makeup. Any adornments were seen as the trappings, the vain trappings of Babylon. And so, yeah, you know, there was a lot of, I grew up kind of bent under this silence of womanhood and in my adolescence. And so when I'm thinking about this idea of the guillotine, it kind of represents the rules and how I felt they severed me from myself when I was growing up, or severed me from the self that I wanted to be.
That's so powerful.
So, you know, I think we actually need to back up and talk more about Rastafari itself, because the sad truth is that for a lot of us, our understanding of it is very basic, like to a comic book level. For instance, even the idea that Rastafari and Jamaican are not the same thing, that like you would be seen as different as a Rasta kid in Jamaica. Can you just talk about that for a minute?
You know, I think most people, I knew when I was sat down to write the book, that most people would be surprised to know that the Rastafari are not actually a majority in Jamaica. But in Jamaica, the Rastafari are historically a persecuted minority. The Rastas make up 1% or less of the Jamaican population. There's probably a few hundred thousand Rastafari. And when the movement began in the early 1930s in Jamaica, Jamaica was still under British colonial rule. And the Rastas were outcast. They were pushed to the fringes. They were seen as pariahs. They were constantly threatened, turned away from their families. In the 60s, we had a prime minister that gave the army, the Jamaican army, the directive to bring me all Rastas dead or alive. Mm. And this led to this really bad, like the worst atrocity in Jamaican history, where they rounded up all the Rastas. They tortured them, forcibly cut their beards, cut their dreadlocks. An unknown number of them were killed. And, you know, it wasn't something that was even taught in schools as history. I kind of learned it through my father and through growing up Rastafari. And only recently has the Jamaican government kind of started to make amends for that, what they call the Coral Gardens Massacre and Bad Friday. And so this is all part of Jamaican history, that Rastafari from the beginning were kind of seen as the black sheep. You know, the police, you did target practice with pictures of Rasta brethren. And it became so bad that even now in Jamaica, in Patois, when people say Babylon, they mean police. Mm. So it's a Babylon down the road. That means police is down the road.
Well,
yeah.
You go through a lot of this history in the course of the memoir. That's one of the important parts of the book, is that you're putting your life in this historical context.
Yeah.
You said 1930 is when Rastafari began. Give us that story a little bit. How and where did Rastafari develop?
You know, it's funny because I only had the broadest strokes of this history before I began to write the book. And I feel like I, in the writing of it, had to become like a Rastafari scholar from scratch,
wow.
You know, because there isn't a lot of written material about this. And there is no like written book of tenets of Rastafari. Most of it is just the wisdom and the knowledge of the history passed down from brethren to brethren.
It's an oral culture.
Yes. And it wasn't really passed down to the women. So I had to,
there's that,
you know, step in and pass it down to myself. Mm, mm. But, you know, it began in the early 1930s with a street preacher named Leonard Percival Howell, who was a fan of Marcus Garvey, the Pan-African abolitionist, who was also Jamaican. And Marcus Garvey had given one of his last speeches. He said, "Look to Africa for the crowning of a black king, for he will be the redeemer." And around the same time, the Ethiopian emperor Haile Selassie had been coronated in Africa. And when Howell heard news of this, he took it as a sign, because Haile Selassie was the only black ruler in the world at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Ethiopia was the only African nation to never be colonized. And so the movement of Rastafari began to like harden around this man, Haile Selassie, this black ruler, who then was an inspirational, aspirational figure for black people. And just remember, at the time in the 1930s, Jamaica was still a colony of Britain. We didn't have our independence yet. And so for them, Haile Selassie represented this dream of black liberation and black independence, of building something outside of the British Empire. Yeah, and so the movement of Rastafari really gathered strength from there. And Howell in Jamaica, you know, started going around and preaching about Haile Selassie as this sort of godhead figure, this aspirational figure of black liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of went from there. And, you know, and then immediately the British government attacked them, Howell had a commune where he had about 3,000 Rastafari people living there peacefully. And the government, the British government, came and burnt it to the ground. They declared it was a cult, and it was, you know, they came and just burnt it. Yeah.
As they would do to a Black liberation movement.
Yeah.
What, you hinted at this a little bit in talking about your parents, but this is a religious, as this is a political, a religious movement. What do Rastafari believe? I recognize that's a ridiculously
broad question.
you know,
because a Rasta might be like, I don't believe in nothing. Mm. You know, like to them, words like believe, faith, religion are colonial words. Those are the words of Babylon, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't say Rastafari is a religion. My father would say Rastafari is a way of life. Huh. And they call it liberty, right? So when they talk about walking the path of Rastafari, they call it their liberty, right? So this, the whole philosophical and spiritual idea of being Rastafari is wrapped up in this idea of liberty. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, stemming from this anti-colonial root of where the movement began, you know, Rastafari mostly is still a Pan-African, it has roots in this Pan-African idea. A lot of Rastafari kind of yearn for repatriation to Africa. So they are for the liberation and upliftment of Black people all across the diaspora. They also have, you know, kind of specific rules about what they eat. You know, they don't eat meat, fish. They completely have a vegan diet that they call Ital. They, of course, wear their hair in dreadlocks, which is for them not a style. It is an absolute must. It's a sacred marker of their reverence to Rastafari, and a marker of their purity and devotion to Jah, which is what they call, you know, the Godhead figure. Mm.
You mentioned Babylon a number of times.
Yeah. just
in case, I don't want to assume understanding of the idea of Babylon. Explain when you refer to Babylon, what that means.
So Babylon represents all the systems that the Rastafari see as tied to the repression of an enslavement of Black people. So it's tied, when it began in the 1930s, it was tied directly to British colonial empire. It's tied to ideas of Western ideology, Western theology, Christianity, slavery. So they see this all as one system, all connected, that is working to repress Black people. Mm-hmm. That's Babylon. Yeah. So everything that a Rastaman sees as evil, as impure, as heathenistic, that's Babylon.
And what about all of this do you think was so powerful and appealing to your parents?
You know, I think both of my parents, who were born, they were both born in 1962, which was the year that Jamaica gained their independence from Britain. So they were born at a time of, you know, great uprooting in Jamaica, a kind of cultural revolution where Jamaica was at that point going to figure out what kind of nation they were going to be now that they were free of the shackles of colonialism. And so it was around this time in the 60s and 70s where reggae was at the height of its popularity. And reggae, of course, is directly tied to Rastafari and its ideals. Reggae is the musical manifestation of the prayer of Rastafari. Mm-hmm. And, you know, both my parents, who kind of grew up almost orphaned, you know, I think in their youth were searching for something, like a lot of Jamaican youth, you know, in the throes of this rebellion and revolution. And Rastafari, I think, provided for them a place where they felt safe. They felt at home. They felt included in a movement that gave them a kind of power as Black people that they never had before.
Mm. Well, I mean, we had a show a couple of weeks ago where we were trying to define what is Black freedom.
Yes.
You know, well, we asked callers in general what is freedom to them, but we were specifically talking about what is Black freedom, and I don't have a definition of it.
I don't either. it's a broad one. Yeah.
It sounds to me like to your parents, this was a potential definition, and that's one of the things that appeals to it.
Absolutely, I think for them it did feel like a kind of freedom that, and Howell's idea, you know, of having a Black nation kind of live in harmony and work toward this goal of, you know, ultimately upliftment was something that also appealed to them. And yearning for feeling, you know, all of us who are Black in the diaspora kind of feel this, like, strange amputation from our roots or where we came from. And I think for my parents, feeling like there was a place where they could look to and say, that's where we came from, and that's where we belong, and that's where we want to be, had had potency for them.
I'm Kai Wright. I'm talking with Sophia Sinclair about her new memoir, How to Say Babylon. After a break, her decision to leave Jamaica and the road to healing with her father.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rahima, and I help produce the show. I want to remind you that if you have questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Here's how. First, you can email us. The address is notes@wnyc.org. Second, you can send us a voice message. Go to notesfromamerica.org and click on the green button that says start recording. Finally, you can reach us on Twitter and Instagram. The handle for both is noteswithkai. However you want to reach us, we'd love to hear from you and maybe use your message on the show. All right, thanks. Talk to you soon.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with poet and essayist Sophia Sinclair about her new memoir, How to Say Babylon. It's as much a history of Jamaica and the Rastafari movement as it is her own family story. And Sophia, at what point did you decide to leave Jamaica?
I mean, you know, for me, I don't think of my leaving Jamaica. It did not happen until like 10 years ago. Where I had this moment where I thought, okay, I have to leave or I won't survive this. Mm. Because I began to rebel against the rules. Let me say that. In case it wasn't clear already.
At some point, you're like, I'm climbing the tree.
I'm climbing the tree. And so I questioned everything and I rebelled, and this led to a lot of clashes between me and my father because, you know, a woman who voices her opinion is an instrument of Babylon, right? So when I was 19 years old, I decided to cut my dreadlocks. And like I'd said before, I think most people don't realize how important the wearing of dreadlocks is to the Rastafari. Like, to my father, this was the way that you expressed your devotion to Rastafari. You know, in the same way that, you know, a nun might wear a habit or someone mm-hmm. wears a turban, that is what the dreadlocks represent to the Rastafari. And so it was never a choice for me and my sisters. And when I was 19, I decided, as I began to think about who I wanted to be, What was the future ahead of me? If I continued on this path that my father wanted me to be on, who would that woman be? And I tried to follow the path all the way. And this kind of woman bent under silence and pliance and obedience was not the woman I wanted to be. Mm. And I cut my dreadlocks, and my father was not pleased. You know, he didn't talk to me for about a year. We were living in the same house.
Wow.
And he looked through me like I was a ghost. I had become Babylon. And then my middle sister cut her dreadlocks. Then my youngest sister cut her dreadlocks. And then my mother, who had been growing her dreadlocks since she was 19 years old when she first met my father, cut her dreadlocks. And I think that pushed my father to the edge. I think he saw me at that time as, I guess, maybe the bad seed or sort of the ruin of this idea of the perfect Rasta family. Mm.
I mean, if you were Babylon and you were Babylon in his home, that's what Babylon would do, right? It would destroy Black freedom in this, in this way of thinking.
And, you know, and so he got violent. And that was when I decided I had to leave Jamaica. Yeah, to sort of go out and, you know, nurture that woman that I could become, and nurture that voice and nurture that strength, so that when I did return, I would return in a way that I could speak to him eye to eye.
Yeah. Was there truth to the fact that you were the catalyst for the other women in your family saying, hey, I don't have to do this?
I think so. I think so. You know, I think after I did it, then they sort of got over the fear of doing it also. You know, we talked about it before and always felt that, you know, we didn't feel ourselves within these rules and strictures, within Rastafari. We didn't feel like there was a space for us. Yeah. It wasn't something that we would have chosen for ourselves. And so I think, yes, after I did, then, you know, everyone felt that, okay, maybe I can do it too.
How did you think in real time about that act of rebellion? I mean, it's, and I use that word on purpose, you know, I mean, I think so many of us in our lives, you know, have these moments where we want to have an act of rebellion against something that's put upon us. And it's very scary and hard, and most of us don't do it. And I just wonder how, you know, just how you processed what you were doing at the time.
I just felt free. So, you know, I was like, if this is how it's going to be, then this is how it's going to be. And that's fine. Because the alternative was not, for me, one that I wanted. So I'd rather have the strife and the struggle with my father and, you know, him not seeing me, not hearing me, not acknowledging me, than feeling that I was kind of shackled or restricted under these rules that I didn't feel myself anyway. So, you know, I'd rather be myself and be cast out than to be, I guess, choked under the silence of the rules.
Yeah. You wrote this book.
Yes.
To process a lot of this in public.
Yes.
thinking back to your childhood, having written the book now, are there memories of your father, of your childhood, that you're like, oh, I understand that differently now because I've done this?
I would say that not necessarily memories of my own childhood, but in writing the book, you know, where I had to not only kind of contextualize the history of Rastafari in a broad sense, but also think about how I'm tied to this history of Rastafari. And the tether is my father, right? And so in the writing, I had to explore that. And so I had to ask him, well, why? Why did you feel called by Rastafari? And so I had to, like, do a lot of interviews with him for the first time to hear about his connection to Rastafari. And he told me about his childhood and his adolescence and how his mother kicked him out because he was a Rastafari, you know, he decided to be a Rastafari at 16, 17. She left him on the street. Mm. And so, I learned a lot having those conversations with him that I didn't necessarily know before in that way, in that detail. And then I began to think about his own traumas in a way that I'd never thought before. Mm. So I would say, that's the biggest thing I learned in the writing. Yeah.
When you say in a way that you'd never thought before, what was that shift?
I mean, you know, like I was talking about before, my father loomed so large in our lives. You know, he was the entire son. He was the whole world in the house, right? And so for a long time, I never humanized him in my mind because he was this authoritarian, he was this figure that, you know, all the rules came from and all the, you know, the words came down from him. And we never talked father to daughter, human person to person, you know, in a close way. It was always, this is what I'm saying you should do. This is what you should think. This is who you are. Like, we've never had.
Yeah. Which is to say, he dehumanized himself, actually.
Actually.
Like, he made himself into a figurehead instead of a person.
Yes. And so then I had to, like, do the work of, reversing that. Mm-hmm. And seeing him in a way that I'd never seen him before. Because I don't think, for me and how I was thinking about writing the book, it wouldn't work the way I wanted it to work if I didn't have that chapter or those moments of, well, how did he come to this, you know?
As his own act of rebellion against what he was supposed to be.
Against his Christian family, yeah.
What was his reaction when he learned you were writing the book? I mean, you had to go interview him and be like, hey, Dad, we're going to talk about some stuff.
I think my family by that point was used to me writing about them. Mm. They're like, okay, this is just what she does. She, you know, because I'd written poems about them in my poetry collection. So they were kind of used to that. And I'd been writing and publishing poems since I was 16. And so I don't think he necessarily understood all the facets of what writing a memoir was going to mean until I think a little bit later. But I think he was very happy to actually have me call him and ask him about Rastafari. Mm. And ask him about his adolescence and his childhood. You know, I think he was happy to be able to speak about it for the first time to somebody.
It's so funny that, you know, he had years to invite you into that conversation. I mean, this isn't to judge him, but it's us as humans. You know, he had all those years raising you to invite you into a conversation about a Rastafari that it turns out he deeply wanted.
Yeah.
And wasn't inviting you into.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And by the end of the book, I was like, I wonder how this all would have gone if I had felt invited into the conversation from the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
because the sort of wisdom and history of Rastafari, as I said before, is passed down from brethren to brethren. You know, women aren't necessarily invited into the circles of their spiritual talks that they call reasoning, where Rasta brethren meet and talk about things, talk about the world and their sort of philosophical desires. And women aren't invited into those reasonings. And I did wonder if I had felt welcome and invited the whole time, how would this have gone?
Yeah.
I don't know, you know? Yeah.
What is your relationship to Rastafari now? Or how do you think about Rastafari now?
You know, I think about it as something that was completely defined, a large part of my life, how I grew up, and shaped me into the person I am now, for better or for worse. I do think about the things that I take away from Rastafari that are good, that are positive, which is rooted in this anti-colonial thought and this idea of, you know, celebrating my Blackness and Black liberation as the vision that we have for the future. And so I take that away. You know, when I came to the U.S. for the first time and I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and having to sort of reckon with that history of racism in the U.S., I always walked tall as a Black woman because of Rastafari.
Mm.
Let's say that.
Wow. You had the tools to reach for to protect your Blackness, if not necessarily your womanhood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about your relationship to your father? What's that like now?
You know, it's an interesting one. I think that he, over the years, has definitely softened. He's definitely began to make amends. And I think he's proud of me, you know? Yeah. I know that because he said that. And I think he's happy that I am writing about Rastafari and this thing that is so deeply crucial and important to him and his life. And yeah, I think in the writing of the book, it has begun to be this kind of conduit for healing.
What about for you, though? How do you feel about him?
Oh, how do I feel about him? I feel, you know, Kai, that question can change day to day.
Rightly and truly.
Today, I feel good about him. Yeah. I was home a month ago, and we sat down, and we had a very nice conversation, and he apologized to me for the first time about a lot of the things that had happened or the way that he chose to sort of manifest the rules in the house. And so I think we're on a good path. That was a good step. We're on a good path, you know, to some kind of change.
And lastly, your relationship to Jamaica. You said both that Jamaica is home,
yeah,
and that you felt like you had to leave to survive.
I had to leave my home, my house, my family's house. But Jamaica for me is always home. You know, I dream about the sea every night. You know, so yes, it's always calling me back. And I go back. I'm there very often, you know. So Jamaica will always be home for me.
I saw somewhere that you described your poetry and your writing as you wanted to evoke the lushness.
Yes.
Of Jamaica.
Yeah.
Which I hear it.
Yeah. So, you know, in the crafting of everything, I take direction from, home and its landscape as how I want to weave the sentences across the page and how I want the reader to experience Jamaica. I want you to feel as skin close to Jamaica as I do, that you could kind of feel the humid kiss of my homeland when you read my work.
I love that language. So great. Sophia Sinclair's memoir is called How to Say Babylon. Thank you so much for this conversation,
Thank
Sophia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Notes from America is a production of WNYC Studios. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and on Instagram at Notes with Kai. You can always talk to us. Go to our website at notesfromamerica.org and look for the little green record button. Just click and leave a message for us right there. I'd really love to hear what came up for you listening to Sophia's story, so do give me a shout about it. A special thanks this week to Kusha Navadar, our senior digital producer. This is his last week with us. Kusha, thanks so much for everything you've done for our show and our community. Mixing and theme music by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Karen Frillman, Florencia Gonzalez, Regina Dahir, Rahima Nassa, David Norville, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Andre Robert Lee is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. Thanks for listening.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.